Thank you for listening to the Ask AI podcast. To get our latest episodes, AI news, discount codes for events, and links to free resources, sign up to our monthly newsletter by visiting askai.org and clicking the subscribe link. That's askai.org.
This episode is sponsored by Cinchi. Cinchi is the enterprise data collaboration platform that enables people, systems, and AI to co-produce intelligent, reusable data products in real time. By eliminating data integration from IT delivery, Cinchi also makes it virtually impossible to violate data protection controls as you leverage AI technology for your business. If you are an enterprise IT leader looking to de-risk and accelerate your AI journey, this is what you've been looking for. Visit Cinchi.com to learn more.
Hey folks, it's Chris McClellan, the producer here at Ask AI. In this episode, we're exploring the intersection of artificial intelligence and the future of work. AI technology is revolutionizing industries worldwide and reshaping how we approach tasks, how we collaborate, and it's really forcing us to think deeply about what it means to have a uniquely human skill. A World Economic Forum report in 2023 revealed that of those surveyed, 49% anticipated AI to be a catalyst for job creation, while 23% expected it to drive job displacement. A similar report from McKinsey predicted that 1 in 16 workers may have to switch occupations in the near future, meaning the workplace will see a great deal of change over the next few years. But there's no question, as AI becomes more integrated into the workforce and workplaces, we're facing challenges such as job displacement, skills gaps, and ethical considerations that surround this technology. Yet, as has been the case with other revolutions in workplace technology, there may also be opportunities for workers to adapt, upskill, and even thrive in entirely new and interesting ways. But whichever direction this all heads, it's essential for individuals, businesses, and policymakers to anticipate and prepare for the changes that AI will bring. Could it be that the future of work isn't about humans versus machines, but about collaboration and synergies between AI and human intelligence? Or is that just hopelessly optimistic? Melissa's guest in this episode is Jared Lindzen. He's a freelance journalist and a public speaker based in Toronto. He covers a wide range of subject areas, including technology, entertainment, and business, but increasingly he's emerging as one of our country's leading voices on the future of work. Jared writes regularly for the BBC, Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, Time Magazine, and Fast Company, and his work has been featured in the New York Times, The Guardian, Fortune Magazine, and Rolling Stone. So we were very fortunate to get some of his time to talk about how AI is going to impact the evolution of work.
Typically, we interview, you know, professors or researchers or developers. What makes being a journalist give you a unique vantage point on the landscape of AI?
So the interesting thing about any emerging technology as a journalist is there's so many unknowns and there's so many opinions and perspectives about what could be. And so often when I'm covering any new technology, but AI especially, because there's so much hype and so much potential, a lot of folks try to shape that hype and potential around the product or service or thing that they're doing, whatever it is. And, you know, often it's interesting, I'll hear totally contradictory predictions about AI. And often, you know, people will suit the research, the little that is known to sort of suit their needs. So it is interesting to kind of get a range of perspectives, some of which are ironically, you know, totally in opposition, but no one can say for sure which is right yet because it's still, you know, not yet there.
So wait, are you suggesting that people try to leverage the media for their own personal gain?
I know it's a shocker. I know it's a shocker. I'm sorry to shatter everybody's impression of the journalist, the fifth estate here, but we get a lot of that and our job is to cut through the noise. And when it comes to AI, there's a lot of noise.
To me, the noise seems late. Like, I was getting super excited about this stuff a decade ago. When did AI really get on your radar?
Well, so here's where we have to start distinguishing AI. If we're talking about machine learning, ages ago. If we're talking about generative AI, the second that OpenAI released ChatGPT and not a second before it. So there's been a lot of rumblings and talk about AI, but it's always been really hypothetical. And especially, you know, in my sort of expertise in my area, which is the future of work and jobs, AI was really, you know, this future job killer that everyone was afraid of that was going to destroy the, you know, labor market and the economy. But not really anything like tactile that you could really wrap your arms around besides machine learning. You know, machine learning existed. We could point to it. We could say that's what it is. That's what it does. This is who's affected by it. But AI was always this sort of like future dream that people had a lot of ideas about, but nobody really had any, you know, sort of confirmation. And so, you know, definitely been having this AI conversation for a long time, but it really became a whole other conversation about, you know, year and a half, 2 years ago.
I was really getting interested 2013, 2014, 2018 when transformer models came out. It was literally perfect timing for when I was running my startup. And then certainly, I mean, with OpenAI, I had access to GPT-3 through a developer platform among the first 700 people in the world in July 2020. And what they released, I believe, November 2022 was better, but like it was already blowing our minds back in 2020, but just didn't have the same access because of the wrapper, right? Like it was, you had to work with developers, it was an API versus like just making it a chat function. And that was really what made it more accessible. And what I think they nailed is the usability and making it so like an everyday person could now interact with these highly complex systems.
Absolutely. You know, ChatGPT was like the exact center point of the Venn diagram between usability, cost efficient in that it was totally free, and super technologically advanced. And that's really what blew everybody's minds because it had all three. And to that point, you know, there was nothing that hit all three of those at the same time.
Are there Canadian companies that are getting close to hitting that trifecta?
There's a lot that are leveraging ChatGPT, OpenAI's software to sort of do their own thing. But at this point, you know, it's really just the giants that are building their own, you know, foundational AI technology, you know, the Googles, Microsofts, IBMs, whatever of the world. And then everyone else is latching on to those products and tweaking them and creating their own version of it. So there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in the world of AI in Canada. Just about every technology company and a whole lot of non-technology companies are working on something related to AI. But in terms of the foundational technology, not as much of that happening in Canada. We kind of just, you know, gave the world the technology in the form of the godfathers of AI who came up with it, and then like insulin gave it to the Americans who then took it and charged everybody a whole bunch of money for it.
I was just going to say that. I was like, just like insulin. Look what we invented. It's free. Oh, wait, you're making money.
Yeah. Hey, America, check out this cool thing we just created. Can you do anything with it? Anyway, no, that's jokes aside. Point of pride that this did come out of Canada for sure. In terms of being pioneers of the next phase of the development, unfortunately, this country just doesn't have the resources to take this technology to the next level, which is, you know, a reality that it takes billions, you know, to go from the models that Dr. Hinton at UFT created and the godfathers of AI, this sort of concept into reality.
Is there anyone who you think is doing a really good job, or maybe some companies that you think are on the cusp of being great examples?
From my perspective, it's been interesting to see a lot of companies trying to figure out. I feel like wherever you were in the development cycle on the day that, you know, OpenAI launched ChatGPT, your entire product just pivoted to incorporate AI. And I feel like we're in this phase now where so many people are throwing stuff against the wall to see what sticks that it's kind of hard to say which one's going to be a winner, which is, you know, understandably why some of the investors are trying to, you know, play it slow here, even though the need for capital is immediate. There's going to be a handful of winners and a heck of a lot of losers and sort of sifting through that. If I knew which ones were going to be the winners, I would be in venture capital and not a journalist. But just about every company is trying to find a way to, yeah, commercialize the technology in one way or another. I think Right now, obviously, you know, the well-established incumbents have got a lot of advantages. The ones who are figuring out how to do the thing that they were doing before very well with the addition of AI have got a pretty good shot. The startups, it's the Wild West out there, as it is anytime there isn't any new technology. And it's very difficult to say, like, this is the model that works. This is the approach that works.
So you mentioned this briefly, but let's go into these copyright issues and, like, you know, as a, you know, having your work featured in the New York Times, like, obviously the lawsuits that OpenAI is facing, copyright issues. And as someone who writes original work yourself, like, talk to me more about not just your academic thoughts and feelings about this, but how you actually feel, kind of tapping into that, like, future of work side for you. Like, this is your work, this is your livelihood. It's your copyright on what you do as a journalist. How do you feel about these seemingly, to me, blatant copyright infringements?
Totally.
And lack of remorse.
Yeah. I mean, all right, let me try and handle these one at a time, because there's a lot in that question that I feel strongly about. I mean, first things first, it's a little freaky to type into ChatGPT, you know, give me an article written like Jared Lindzen, and then see what it spits out. That's, you know, I didn't sign up for that, but my work is all over the internet. And, you know, I definitely have a specific writing style that you wouldn't notice from reading one or two articles. But if you took everything I've ever written, you'd start to find patterns. And so that was an eye-opening moment. At the same time, the content that's coming out of there, like, I know I've got a few years. AI is a really good first draft generator. It can help you organize some thoughts and ideas, maybe make a few suggestions, but this is not ready for the big leagues. This is not, you know, you're not going to see a front page New York Times article written by, at least not this year or next year. So I know I've got a little bit of time ahead of me. The stuff that's coming out of it, people are very impressed, of course, because it is very impressive, but you know, I think if you showed an artist some of the work that comes out of these image generators, they would be less impressed than your average person who just is toying with the technology. When I use an image generator, what comes up to me looks amazing, but if I were to show an actual artist, they'd find a ton of flaws in it. Same thing is happening with the written work. You know, you can put a prompt into ChatGPT, get it to write an essay. It's not, I mean, it's good. It's just not, you know, it's a lot better than anything we've seen before. Credit where credit is due, but it's definitely not at a professional level yet, which gives me some encouragement that, you know, I'll still have a job for a little while here. But yeah, you know, it is also a little bit freaky to know that, like, in the past, I was writing about job displacement and automation in, like, a factory setting, in, like, a very different kind of world, and writing about it as, like, a concept that felt a little far away from home. And now it's, like, you know, sort of knocking at my back door, being like, you better up your game because the technology is coming to take your job. I don't think it's there yet, but it's definitely, yeah, it's been an interesting experience to see this very powerful new technology kind of doing the exact thing that I do for a living.
Has that made your writing and your work more personal in a way? Like, are you like, oh, wait, these factories that I wrote about, these poor people, oh, no, it's me. Like, how has that changed your writing?
I mean, yeah, a little bit. It's definitely, you know, it's no longer theoretical. That I'll say for sure. It's very real. But at the same time, you know, I was trying to be empathetic to the people who were being affected. And, you know, now I'm one of them. But at the same time, you know, I think as with all technology, you might not need as many people on the factory floor, but you're still going to need people on the factory floor. You might not need as many people in the newsroom, but you're still going to need a newsroom with actual humans in it. I think that what we're going to be able to do is going to rapidly advance. I also think there will be new opportunities for writers and journalists and storytellers and people with, you know, creative skill sets in a more robotic world. So, you know, it's a little bit of like that immediate shock, like, oh, I might be in trouble. But then as I dig into it, I think, A, it's not there yet. B, there's still a lot that it will never be able to do. Like, I don't see it conducting interviews and then organizing those thoughts into like a cohesive conclusion. You know, like, there's still stuff that I can do that it can't. And at the same time, it's, you know, I'm starting to play with some tools that are making me better at my job, faster, you know, more efficient. And that is encouraging as well. I am afraid that there's going to be less journalists in the future. Definitely a concern. There's, those journalists will be able to do much more than, you know, an individual can today. We're getting to a point now where, like, you can have all of the resources of a newsroom in the 70s on your laptop as an individual, which is exciting and scary at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why we have, like, alternative news.
Oh, God, no, let's not talk about disinformation because that's going to drive me insane. Trust me, if I had an answer to, like, people building their own realities with the information that they want in that reality, we could be here all day.
For sure. So there's a couple things. I still want to go a little bit deeper on the feature work because I know that's your bread and butter. But two things before that is, you know, when you talk about, like, fewer journalists and being more efficient as, like, maybe a downside, maybe a slightly positive thing, like you're more efficient. But at the same time, you know, we've already seen the evisceration of newsrooms. Like, local news is just not being covered, even in Canada, certainly, right? You think of these old, like, style local newspapers that held municipal city councilors accountable. And now you're seeing all this stuff where impropriety is going on for years, if not decades, and no one's finding out because it's not in the nightly paper, because there's not the local journalist that is paid for by all the people who pay for the local subscriptions to have someone holding these elected officials accountable. It's pretty scary what we're seeing. So I see journalists as such an important part of society, and it's already in a dangerous place with how few we have. And if we're already on a track to have even fewer, that is highly concerning to me.
Oh, yeah. No, you're preaching to the choir here. I'm concerned as well. I wish I had some sort of financial model that would work for them. You know, the best I could hope for is that people who want to do this as, you know, citizen journalists, as non sort of tied to a institution or an entity, at least have the opportunity to be trained in some of the basics. Because that's really what scares me. There's no lack of people who want to cover the news or to, like, be involved in one way or another, but often they're just not adhering to just some of the basic principles of journalism, which, you know, people will say journalism's dying because it's so rigid in all of these ways, but those ways are sort of necessary for objectivity. And, you know, I know that there is going to be, like I said, an individual could have all the resources of a newsroom. The question is, do they have the same ethical standards as a newsroom? And that's really what concerns me. So it's not the lack of resources, it's the lack of standards. And I would love for AI to somehow bring us to a world where, you know, there's just better. I wish that the reward system that we have, which currently rewards attention, which currently incentivizes strong emotions, were to somehow flip so that it incentivized accuracy and truth and all the good things that we want in journalism. And I hope that as traditional journalism starts to disappear in a very discouraging way, especially at the hyper-local level where it's needed most, what replaces it is some kind of system where individuals who are passionate and want to do this work, which there are plenty, even on their spare time, are able to do it, but under an umbrella, under a structure and a system that incentivizes good, accurate, strong journalism, not getting people riled up and angry as the current social media, you know, sort of system does. So it might be wishful thinking, probably is, but I hope that AI does bring us a little bit closer to accuracy. I hate to say it, but, like, I hate Twitter in so many ways, but community notes is, like, the first time I've seen something on social media that incentivizes accuracy and truth. People don't want to be called out by a community note. I would love to see that model expanded everywhere so that people who want to be involved and, yeah, be that local journalist on their spare time are incentivized to be good at it in that traditional journalistic way.
And this is probably going to be a very easy question for you, but just for our listeners who are predominantly more tech people or people who want to learn more about tech, and again, this is a little bit of a different vein, which is why we're so excited to bring you to our listeners. What are some of the ethical standards that journalists are supposed to adhere to?
I mean, just at the very basics, you know, talking to both sides of an issue and trying to represent their perspective, also fact-checking, you know, pretty standard, but doesn't often happen. And, you know, there's a lot of cherry picking of information. If we're at a point now where if you really want to back up an existing perspective or bias or whatever it is, you can find all the data and interview subjects that you need to do it without ever sort of representing the other side of the argument. Traditional journalism and the standards and ethics that I was trained for in journalism school it doesn't matter whether you agree with it or not. That's not the point. The point is, to demonstrate the perspective of both sides. And if one of those sides is totally inaccurate, at least let them say their point and then demonstrate with third-party data how that point might be inaccurate. There's just a certain commitment to the truth over a certain perspective that just is lacking. There's also a lot of not publishing things before you have enough evidence. Journalism typically requires two unrelated sources before you can run with a story. A lot of people will hear a rumor from an anonymous commenter on the internet and say that this is absolute fact. There's just some very basic stuff there. I sometimes watch these true crime documentaries, especially the ones where they have these sleuths uncovering, and they go on such inaccurate, incorrect paths. They spend so much time researching stuff because some random internet commentator suggested that they go in this direction and they thought it would make for compelling content. And again, so much of it is about the reward system, because getting people riled up and pissed off and angry gets views, clicks, likes, shares, all those other metrics that are incentivized. And the truth is so often boring. And that's the unfortunate reality of the world we live in. The truth doesn't get clicks and views and reshares as much as something shocking that may or may not be based in reality.
So take us home with the future of work. Is Skynet coming? Are all of our jobs being destroyed? Is UBI the solution, universal basic income? Hit me on everything on the future of work, what you're seeing, what you're researching, what you're writing about, where you're at in a non-opinionated journalistic standpoint.
Okay, so in 5 minutes, you want everything I've ever written, everything I'm going to write, all of my perspectives on the entire future of the world, but also the past. All right.
Let's, and go.
All right. Yeah. you know what? Let me give you a very quick rundown of the presentation that I usually deliver, because it really does sort of encapsulate my thoughts on the future of work. So much of the way that we work today is a relatively recent invention that is not based in anything beyond our collective belief that it's the way we are supposed to work. So before the Industrial Revolution, people worked from home. There was no separation between work and life. Whether you were in farming or manufacturing, you were likely working from your home, doing sort of tasks that valued your most human traits, creativity and a strong work ethic and communication. And then came along the factory system in the 1800s, early 1900s, where all that really mattered was showing up to a centralized location and sitting at a workstation for a designated amount of time. Through that period in the early 1910s and 20s, there was a lot of the establishment of the rules of work that exist today through the labor movements that exist, like having 8-hour work days, 5-day work weeks, time off for vacation, all the things that you think are just the way that the world works in terms of work are relatively recent inventions that don't necessarily need to exist. And now we are in a place where work doesn't actually have to happen in a centralized location or even at a specific time or in any specific way. So we have permission to completely rewrite the rules that, again, are a relatively recent invention that are not based in anything beyond our collective belief in their necessity. So, there are companies doing a 4-day work week and finding that their people are more productive in 4 days than in five. There's also companies that are, going fully remote, of course, and having no issue with it and finding that, in fact, their people are more engaged. There's other companies that are really struggling with remote work, and that's a whole other conversation as well. But the point is that the rules that have existed to dictate how we work for at least 100 years and probably longer no longer apply, and that a lot of companies are just going to keep doing what they've always been doing because it's the way things have always been done. But there is now the opportunity, the resources, and the permission to experiment. And that's what's got me excited. I don't think every company is going to be fully remote. I don't think every company is going to be 4-day work. I don't think every company is going to be anything. I think the idea is that there is no longer one size fits all way of doing things Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 in person. I think that every company can now kind of sit down with their staff, with their workload, with their objectives, and determine which structure works best for them, and then build a workforce and a way of working around it. That's what's different now. And all the other little details, UBI, 4-day work week, remote work, those are all just sort of options that are on the table that may not have been realistic just a handful of years ago. How did I do?
Absolutely. Oh, so good. So thank you. I mean, you know, you talk about the 4-day work week and it makes me think of like something I've been really thinking about is actually like a 7-day rotation where there's no such thing as like weekends anymore. Like, what do you mean weekends? Like some people are like Sunday to Wednesday and some people are like Tuesday to Thursday or some people are like Thursday to Monday or something. Like you don't have like hours of business because that's not even really a thing. And especially in a global economy, you kind of need support and services and people all the time. And there are people who are going to want to work different times,
yep,
just based on where they're at in life. So my thing has actually been, what if we all just like worked on a rotation and had some overlap and like there's no concept of like it must be Monday to Friday.
Right. So the thing that's missing to get to that world of just extreme flexibility where work and life are totally integrated, you work when you want to, when you can, the thing that's missing is just a really consistent, accurate way to measure productivity, which we don't yet have. There are some roles where it's very easy to know that you did this much in sales this quarter and that is...
Exactly.
Yeah, but there's so many jobs out there. And of course, employers aren't willing to go by the honor system for their entire workforce, especially larger organizations. Just say, do it on your own schedule and just get it done whenever. Like there needs to be a better way of tracking and measuring productivity. And if we can get there, and smaller companies are having an easier time with this as well, because it's a lot easier to keep track of a smaller group. But if we can get to a place where, you do your thing on your schedule, as long as by next Tuesday, you've hit these metrics. And, we would like you to be available for like 3 hours a day in this window for 5 days a week or for 4 days a week, whatever it is. We could get there eventually. It's going to happen in certain roles and professions and company sizes before others. The first one will be like a very small sales team that can just say, everyone work remotely on your own schedule, but you got to hit these metrics. The last is going to be the giant corporation with like 50,000 people doing a whole variety of jobs, a whole layer of middle management that's only function is to oversee the next layer down. Like they're not going to be able to relinquish that sort of oversight anytime soon. But if we get to worlds where there's a sort of mutually agreed upon metrics and measurement systems for productivity, we can do away with hours entirely. And wouldn't that be a nice world to live in?
I mean, yeah, I'm all for it. So, I mean, this preaching to the choir now, this direction, yeah, it's great. This is so exciting. Thank you for giving us that very robust overview. I think it will really help our listeners who maybe hear all these buzzwords, but don't really know what it means and haven't actually considered that this is such a modern way of working. I remember reading somewhere, didn't fact check it though, about like, oh, medieval peasants had more time off than you. And I was kind of mad about that. But like, again, didn't fact check it. Who knows if it was true?
I mean, they might have, but their quality of life was probably not great.
Also true. But yeah, it's just there's so many evolutions in the way that we work. And it is a really interesting time to be alive, to be working.
Yeah. Let me throw one thing at you just to sort of hammer it home. Let me remember the name of it. Parkinson's Law. Are you familiar with Parkinson's Law?
I'm not.
Okay.
Only the disease.
No, not that Parkinson's. Different Parkinson. Pretty sure it was a different Parkinson. I should double check. But the idea is that work expands to fill the time allotted for its completion. And that is like a foundational principle that there's a reason why, for example, in the UK, they work like 200 hours less than in the United States, yet there's no difference in the average output of an individual person. When you have more time to do something, you tend to waste more time or you don't do it as effectively. And so there's this whole, especially in the 4-day work week movement or the work time reduction movement, there's this concept that there's so much wasted time that doesn't need to be there. And with the right processes and systems and incentives, you could actually do more in less time. So anyway, I think Parkinson's Law kind of encapsulates a lot of, how work could change in very dramatic ways without actually affecting the viability of a business or the productivity of its workers.
and with AI, right?
Well, that's the other big factor. Yes, bring it full circle.
There it is.
Well, there's a lot of conversation. I mean, our friend Bernie Sanders last week was talking about the 4-day work week in the same context. And he's not the only one. I mean, Bill Gates has talked about it. Jamie Dimon has talked about it. So it's not just, you know, the far left. But there's a lot of...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Oh, when Jamie Dimon came out about all that, I was like, yes.
Well, the other thing is, like, what are you doing, Jamie Dimon, to reduce the work week of your workers? Can anyone actually work 4 days in your organization?
Just watch that, because wasn't he the one who was like, oh, crypto's a scam, and then he was, like, one of the biggest buyers that week? Like, we got everything that comes out of that man's mouth. Watch it. So if he's saying... Yay, 4-day work week. He is about to set up some 7-day sweatshop somewhere. Watch out.
That's a good point.
Watch this
man. Okay, so don't trust him. But there's been this broader recognition culturally that, like, we work so many hours for really no reason. And that we could, especially with AI coming, especially with, you know, there's this a lot of these graphs that'll show you that the average human productivity has just been skyrocketing in the last 50 years, but the number of hours worked has stayed the exact same. And if you think about it theoretically, if we as individuals are getting so much more productive, why are we still working as long? And especially with AI that's like expected to take this to another exponential level, why do we expect to continue working as long in the future? It was predicted in like the 1910s and 20s that by this point in time, people would be working for a few hours a week and that robots and machines would do everything we need for them. And we work more now than we did back then. So the question is, what kind of future do we want? And a lot of folks from Jamie Dimon to Bernie Sanders are saying with AI on the doorstep, we should really be examining whether there's a better way to do things in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, with... increased productivity, increased profits, stagnant wages, higher cost of living. You have opportunities for overemployed people. I'm sure that's a whole other rabbit hole we could go down. These developers will have like two jobs and just like have their daily scrums at different times. I'm sure you've seen that and have thoughts on it. I'm fascinated. I'm not bold enough to do it. Like, I mean, who doesn't have a side hustle? But I'm not like two full-time jobs. I'm like, ooh, spicy. But like, I kind of wish I would, but like, I'm like,
no. I can tell you can do two things at once. You just can't be good at two things at once. So they're like the bottom employee at two different companies. And, you know, like for real, at some point, the bottom's going to drop out.
I love it. All right. Well, Jared, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being with us. This was wonderful. So many laughs and fun, sharp ideas. Any final comments for our listeners?
I would just encourage people who are trying to think about the future of work and feel like it's like this scary thing that they're being forced into against their will, which I think a lot of folks are. I mean, the reality is that things are changing because they can change. And the status quo is the way it is, not because it's the best way of doing things, but because it was the only way of doing things for so long. And, you know, I don't look at things like remote work in a vacuum or hybrid work as like, we need to solve this one thing and then we can just move on. Work is going to be evolving pretty rapidly over the next little while. And the companies that are really resistant to that change are going to struggle with their attraction and retention. So just understand that the reason why you work the way you do doesn't really have any sort of practical purpose to it. You may have a lot of systems built around it that make it harder to change, but there is nothing inherently requiring you to work the way that you do currently. So just remain open to the massive changes that are definitely coming, especially with AI in the future. And don't look at remote work or flexibility as this like one-off thing that just happened because of the pandemic. It's a symptom of a much broader revolution that's already underway.
It's coming. Dun, dun, dun. Well, thank you very much, Jared. Super appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
My goodness, what an episode. We covered a lot of ground. Thank you so much to Jared for being with us. I loved his overview on the future of work. I loved his positive outlook amid his real, you know, worries, talking about how it's very creepy to go to ChatGPT and say, write like me, write in my style, knowing that it has consumed all of the articles. But we also touch on how we can have a potentially much more equitable society with less work and fewer working hours and fewer confines and a greater blend between work and life instead of the bounds that we've felt for the last 100 years.
This episode was edited by James Fajardo. Original music was provided by Mike Letourneau. The series producer was Chris McClellan. To view the episode transcript, stream the video version, and get helpful links, check out the episode post in the Ask AI blog.